Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts, including Intelligence Squared US, Oxford-style debates recorded live in New York. After hearing the world's leading authorities share surprising facts and reasoned analysis, you might just rethink your point of view on some big issues. Find Intelligence Squared US on iTunes under podcasts. It's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Stephen Thompson, filling in for Linda Holmes as she watches 8 zillion movies at the Toronto International Film Festival. This week on Pop Culture Happy Hour, we discuss the celebrity apology. Recent months have been filled with backlash against statements made by everyone from Ricky Gervais to Henry Rollins to CeeLo Green to the recently departed Joan Rivers. On this episode, we'll discuss high-profile apologies, forgiveness, truth-telling, who gets away with what, and why. Then it's on to an old favorite for which we'll never apologize, the regrettable television pop quiz. And then we close, as always, with what's making us happy. Before we get things started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table and meet the newly reconstituted Pop Culture Happy Hour crew, Glenn Weldon. What do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Kat Chow, how about you? What do you do for NPR?
I do social media stuff, and I blog for Code Switch.
And hey, Gene Demby, what do you do for NPR?
I'm the lead blogger and correspondent for Code Switch.
Now, we're taping this on Monday, and this past Thursday, we lost comedian, actor, talk show host, and all-around rabble-rouser, Joan Rivers. Now, Joan Rivers was, among other things, no stranger to provocative statements, which got us thinking about issues surrounding celebrity apologies. But before we dig in, I thought we might have a quick discussion of Joan Rivers' legacy. And Glenn, do you have some thoughts on Joan Rivers?
Sure. I mean, I came to know her when she was still, doing things like the Mike Douglas Show and the Merv Griffin Show, and she hadn't really quite found herself. She was still doing all the jokes about how ugly she was and how her husband hated her and all that kind of stuff. It was only after, I would say, around the 80s or 90s, when the gays embraced her, that she started to do a lot of humor that's based on appearance, humor that's very cutting humor that's based on, you know, her own appearance and other people's appearance, fashion, that kind of thing, which endeared her to the gays and made her a subject of some controversy that she blissfully didn't give a crap about. Her response to any kind of controversy was always the same thing. She would say, oh, grow up and move on. Mm-hmm. So a couple of really great encomiums to her. There was Julie Klausner's on Vulture and Casey St. Onge's on XO Jane. Both of those are women in comedy, and what they have to say is a hell of a lot smarter than what I have to say about her. But she was a legend, and she will be missed.
Joan Rivers always seemed to be, you know, kind of getting us into the topic of the celebrity apology. Joan Rivers never really apologized mm-hmm. when she said things were controversial. And I mean, even just a few weeks before her death, she had made statements about Palestinians that were very, very upsetting to people. But there's something about the way that she always seemed to be like performing at a celebrity roast for the world.
Right.
And, you know, when you're in the celebrity roast, it's no holds barred. You're able to say whatever the harshest thing you can possibly imagine. And it was very interesting to me. She had carved out that place where apologies weren't really part of the process of saying things that offended people.
To Glenn's point, it seems like later in her career, she started to be much more pointedly cutting about people. It also sort of dovetails with like the beginning of social media. It seems like there's so much more stuff that she would have to apologize for if she was so inclined. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like part of the thing, and Kat and I joke about this all the time because we write about race, like there should be sort of like a Mad Lib for how to apologize for sort of, you know, grievances of the day. And it's not to say they're all equal. I mean, she dismissed some criticisms that would have been nice for her to have addressed, namely the Palestinian one. I mean, I think that was like at a time when we were seeing all these crazy images coming out of the Middle East. I forget who the comedian was who said she made a joke right after 9/11 about going to dine at Windows of the World.
Right.
And there's a sort of like her shtick. The orientation that people have to celebrities is so much different now because of Twitter, because of all these other things, and the metabolism is so much faster. I almost wonder if like she could even keep up with all the apologies she'd have to issue.
Yeah.
Well, you made an interesting point about the Mad Lib of the celebrity apology. And Kat, you and I were talking about this a little bit before the show, that you guys have, like at the Code Switch blog, have running jokes about the way celebrities have to apologize for like racially insensitive remarks.
Yeah, completely. So, I mean, whenever any sort of situation happens where someone says something remotely racist and everyone gets upset and you sort of see the situation bubble up, you can always kind of predict that there's going to be an apology. And then if that person is white, there's going to be someone else who steps in and says sorry for them. And I mean, I think we can say that's true. So back in June, I think Justin Bieber it came out that there was some video that TMZ published that showed Bieber telling jokes where he used the N-word. And we saw this happen, and I remember Gene and I and the rest of the Code Switch team were kind of waiting for Bieber to come out with his apology. And we knew it was going to be something like, I am humbled and embarrassed, and I was young then. And I think at the time, Justin Bieber was 15 or 16. He was a teenager.
Mm-hmm. I always loved the way humbled always means everything except actual humility.
Yeah. And they'll always kind of step back from what they actually said. They'll say something like, that wasn't my intention. In Bieber's actual apology, he said something to the effect of, I was young then, and now I'm a man. I'm pretty sure that the word man was used in his apology. And then Usher came out not too long after Bieber had this whole kerfuffle and apologized for him and said, Justin Bieber is not a racist. Because we needed, you know, a black guy to sign off.
Mm. Yeah. To just, like, fill out the paperwork that says, you know, not a racist.
Yeah.
Well, for my own personal biases here, I was thinking about who do I cut a lot of slack and who do I cut absolutely none? And comedians fall into that category of people I cut a lot of slack for. Basically, it's any artist whose whole work is a more or less unmediated version or vision of themselves, right? So Writers, novelists, I cut a lot of slack for this kind of thing. Musicians who write their own stuff, I kind of cut a lot of slack. Visual artists, certainly, because for those categories I just named, we are used to seeing them talk about social issues, gender, politics even. That's part of the work. And so when they do that all the time, my thing is, well, they're going to screw up.
They're walking on a high wire.
Right. As opposed to, and this is not fair, actors, say, and it's not fair because they are putting themselves out there in just a different way. But I don't think anybody's ever come on and said, you know, I can't wait for the third lead from Bones to weigh in on Gaza. That's not a thing.
Right.
They don't do it in their work, except in the actual work. They don't do it as, we don't see themselves. So it's a weird line.
I want to push back on that slightly. I don't know if you saw this piece, Ricky Gervais.
Yeah.
Spoke out recently in response to the leaked selfies of Jennifer Lawrence and others, and was tweeting about, like, well, what you need to do is don't take pictures of yourself, and just straight up victim blaming through and through. Mm-hmm. And there's a marvelous piece on Jezebel by Lindy West about this, in which she talks about what Ricky Gervais originally meant to her, what Ricky Gervais's work was all about, puncturing that, and, like, basically that she felt that his humor had reached a point where he was defending the indefensible against people who were having rotten things done to them. Mm-hmm. And that it was more disappointing to her because he had started out doing comedy that kind of skewered the powerful.
Ignorance, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was an interesting take because it's kind of the opposite of the take that you just made, where you're saying that because comedians are on the front lines of these things, they're going to slip up more. But at the same time, so often comedy is about, in a way, sticking up for the little person.
Yeah, not punching down, as they
right,
say.
Right, perfect.
But I do think there's something going on with a lot of comedians now where there is this almost a prickliness. Comedians who get offended when people get offended by something they say. There's this sensibility of you can laugh or you can shut up. Those are the only two reactions you are permitted. Now, stand-up comedy in particular is a weird art form because the only metric of success is laughter.
Right.
If there's no laughter, then you're not successful. So a lot of the weaker comedians, when challenged, and I maintain that challenging some of this is perfectly within our rights as an audience member, when challenged, they will retreat to, I'm not politically correct. I'm an equal opportunity offender. Blah, 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 free speech. Well, free speech protects you from being slapped in chains by the government. Mm-hmm. There's this ironic racism that they try to hide behind. The source of the humor is that I'm saying it, and everybody knows who I am.
Yeah.
But what that does is it asserts a view of the world which doesn't exist, which is that racism is a joke. Like, a joke is racist as opposed to an entire infrastructure. You're reducing racism to this thing you say as opposed to this thing we live in because you think you can get away with it. Real quick, the last time I was at the DC Improv, a guy comes out, the featured act. He has a 10-minute set. First 5 minutes of that set is just gay voice, just coming out and going, hey, guys, it's really great to be here. It's super. Oh, my God, you guys are so fabulous.
Yeah.
For 5 minutes, which felt like 20.
Right.
Now, as an audience member, one of my reactions could have been getting up and saying, this guy sucks, I'm leaving. I could have heckled. Actually, I couldn't heckle. Heckling is the wrong thing to do.
Right.
Heckling is never right. But the reason I didn't leave is because I wanted him to go so that I could turn to my friends and go, what just happened? Because he got reaction from the crowd. He did. He got a pretty big one from drunks and homophobes. The same reaction he would have gotten at the seventh grade lunch table, which tells me that he's not doing it right. He is trading on the stuff that comes with prepackaged emotional force. He's trading on nervous laughter in the audience, which isn't real laughter. It's not. There's a lot of different reactions we should have to this kind of stuff. We're permitted to have. The least interesting reaction is the Salon article scolding the comedian. Like scolding Patton Oswalt for daring to say the thing he says when he's challenging blah, 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 blah. Like, that's the least interesting one. But all of these are valid.
Differentiating between behavior and speech is a big part of this. And you, Glenn, said something that I really appreciated about the First Amendment does not inoculate you against speech by others.
Right. Exactly.
Like, I don't understand how that is supposed to work. I mean, it's a free marketplace of ideas. You're going to get criticized. That's the price of saying whatever you want.
Right.
But I do think, getting back to the issue of behavior versus speech, we're recording this on Monday, and all day today, there has been a gigantic explosion of frustration and anger about the video that surfaced on TMZ, but that was published on TMZ, of Ray Rice, the former Baltimore Ravens running back, punching his then fiance. And everybody, in the light of having seen that video, then revisiting this horrible press conference that he and his then fiance gave in conjunction with the Ravens, kind of issuing this weird no apology. She actually apologized more than he did. And it was much more stomach turning and nauseating than that kind of, I'm sorry you were offended. Mm-hmm. Or the CeeLo Green, I'm sorry for the
words attributed to
me. I'm sorry for saying that.
I'm sorry.
Gross thing.
I apologize for the words that were attributed to me, which is the slipperiest, squishiest, grossest non-apology.
Yeah, it's that distancing thing.
I mean, setting aside the issue of behavior versus words, I think people who try to weasel out of their apology as they're making it is very upsetting in a way, because it feels like there's such an arrogance implied in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like when you're a little kid and you do something stupid and your parents make you apologize and you're just like, I'm sorry. But you don't mean it. Mm-hmm. And everyone, it's just so frustrating.
Yep. I'm sorry if you were offended. Linda wrote about this very well on the blog.
Yeah, there's a great, I'm not even sure if this is the piece you're referring to, because this is one of Linda's favorite issues, and it pains me so much that she's in Toronto and can't have this conversation with us. She did an amazing piece when John Edwards was issuing an apology, and it was just her advice on how to give a public apology, and I think it ultimately boiled down to go away. Like, the best thing you can do is just leave us alone.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there's this template, right? And I sort of wonder what they think would happen if they were just sincere. Like, if they just
said, or they strayed from the template.
Right. If they said, you know what, that was just messed up, and not even fall on the sword. I mean, just to be honestly contrite.
Henry Rollins recently wrote an article about suicide in the wake of Robin Williams' death, in which he, you know, did that very old-fashioned boilerplate, you know, it's cowardly, it's blah, blah, blah. And he got pummeled for it. Mm-hmm. And his response was to write an article where he was basically like, I am sorry, I was wrong, and I completely understand if you are done with me.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, it's still kind of in that pumped up, slightly self-aggrandizing Rollins way, but it felt different from other apologies.
Right.
I didn't
get the sense that a team of lawyers had seen it before he put it out.
And it feels more genuine, I suppose. And I think that's what we're getting at, is like, none of these apologies that we think of, like the Bieber apology, the Usher one, feel at all sincere.
Well, they often feel like they're written by PR people.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that was Chris Culliver, he's a cornerback for the San Francisco 49ers, who was speaking about gays in the locker room and made some kind of spectacularly dumb and insensitive statement about it. And then when he issued his apology, it came out the next day, like, I wish to express my condolences for my poorly chosen words, and it was just so obviously written by a PR person. And I remember saying, I think I tweeted this at the time, like, there should be a rule that when you say something dumb and inoffensive, you should apologize for it in the same way you made the statement, which in this case would be, duh, sorry.
Yep. And there have been other examples which escape me now of people, when you read it, it doesn't feel like they're ticking off a box. It does feel like some moment of becoming less ignorant has actually happened.
Yeah, like they're actually learning and growing, and maybe they won't think that anymore.
Yeah.
And saying it in their real voice, which is what I was getting at with Colliver. It's just...
It coming from a place of actual regret as opposed to, you know, jurisprudence.
I don't think we've necessarily resolved the issue of how celebrities should apologize, but I'm sure that there are many, many examples dating farther back than we've only been able to focus on the ones in like the last month because there have been so many.
Yeah.
But if you want to chime in and bring up some of your own examples and some of your own apology related pet peeves, go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/PCHH, and tell us what you think. So speaking of regrettability and things for which people should apologize, it is time for our regrettable television pop quiz, in which we listen to some excerpts from some regrettable television and try to see if the panel can guess what they are.
What are you gonna do for the theme song, Stephen?
You got no
Linda. What are you gonna do?
Oh, that's true. Do I do?
You sing yourself.
You should.
Do I sing myself and do the pop?
Self pop.
I self pop. Gosh, the story of my life. All right. Regrettable television pop quiz.
Nice.
Well done.
Thank you. Wow. Thank you. Hit us, Jessica.
You've broken the blood vessels, which is why it's swelling up so much. But listen, I don't want to sugarcoat it. This is a very serious situation.
I just had all these things going through my mind, and they weren't good things. They were bad, really, really bad things.
Paolo's broken.
Who in the world is Paolo?
My...
Oh, dear me.
His penis is broken!
Oh, my goodness. Paolo is...
Oh, my.
We need to pray for Paolo. We need to pray.
Here you go. Any guesses?
Wow.
I think I know.
Whoa.
Okay, let's do the little thing like on Millionaire where we try to talk this through.
This isn't multiple choice?
No multiple choice.
I just had a freak out.
It's got reality TV music.
It's got the reality
TV.
It's got the tuba. Yeah, the tuba of embarrassment.
Yeah.
And the plucky strings of whimsy.
Plucky strings of whimsy, but it also has what sounds like attempts at acting.
Dramatic reenactment, perhaps?
It does have an air of the dramatic reenactment.
I will tell you...
Gene, did you have a guess?
I do have a guess. Sex sent me to the ER?
Sex sent me to the ER.
Oh, that was very good.
Demby for the win.
On TLC. Of course, the multiple Peabody Award winning Sex sent me to the ER. So you got the testimonial interspersed with some of the biggest acting you will ever see from actors who do not hold SAG cards. Let me put it that way. There is some mugging on this show. Oh, my God. Of course, the director believes that the biggest laugh line is, his penis is broken.
Yeah.
In fact, it tells you just how he's not really paying attention because, of course, when you're talking about somebody having something wrong with their penis and the doctor leads off by saying, look, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. That's your line. That's what you focus on. Because then the guy would be like, well, I would certainly hope not. This is not the Dark Ages stuff.
When did that show run?
It's still going on. It's going strong.
It's going strong. Sex sent me to the ER.
The thing that's wild about that show is so many of the injuries are easily explainable by like something other than sex, right? So like I was having sex with my partner in the pool and I like got my foot caught in a vent and it broke and I broke my toe. And it's like, okay, so you go to the hospital and you say you broke your toe in the pool. You don't have to say anything about the sex. You don't. And people are like, they do the dramatization and the people are in the hospital like, how did you break your toe? And they're like, oh no, what do I tell them? You just leave out the part with the sex. It's really easy.
The reactions are just that big.
All right. Hit us, Jessica.
Hey, Kevin. Okay, cool it on the pecs. They're definitely done. You look like one of these girls on the stage. Okay, I'm going to give you an 8.9 on the face.
Your features are close together. Your eyes are a little narrow set.
The hooters are just too big. An 8.5 on the body. And sex appeal, an 8.7. Rachel.
There's just something going on with the hair that I think could be a little bit shorter because it does have that little bit of a hurdle thing going on. And so I give your face an 8.5. Your body also just big boobies, just like you said. 8.9. I would give you also an 8.9 as far as sexual appeal.
Thanks.
Thanks. All right, I don't remember the name of the show.
Yeah, and her voice is very familiar.
But the show...
It's about 10 years ago?
Oh, less than that, I think. But it's Am I Hot or Not? It's something like that. But it's Lorenzo Lamas taking a pointer and pointing out physical attributes
yes.
on people, like a laser pointer.
Right.
It was gross, but I don't remember the name.
Ugh. No, I remember this, too. Is this Fox?
Nope. ABC.
ABC. Oh, wow. Well. Bastion of family programming.
Funny it was CBS. The Tiffany Network.
So the show was Are You Hot? The Are Search Hot? For America's Sexiest People. And it ran, I think, for 5 episodes.
They found the person in, like, episode 5?
Yeah, I guess so. They
just
were like,
found
we just
the
found the
person.
Sexiest person in America.
Our work here is done.
Yeah.
He was a 10.
So, am I hot?
Are you
Are
hot?
You
Are
hot?
Are you hot? So putting the viewer into it, perhaps.
Oh.
You know.
Was
you know,
this before yeah. the era of texting your opinion, your vote? You must have been able to vote for this.
I don't know. Well, I feel like it was
or
an offshoot. I feel like it was inspired by the website Am I Hot or Not?
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I keep wanting to call it Am I Hot?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, man. We're just going to keep that a mystery.
Classy.
All right, Jessica, what do we got?
Mom, we have to talk. I don't know why I ever let your father talk me into this video section, especially these adult ones.
Mom, I'm on my lunch break. I don't have much time.
In and out of Africa. That's sick.
Mom, these fix-ups have to stop. They're humiliating.
The Booberly Hillbillies. They're stretching for that one.
I'm not kidding around, Mom.
You have something against Korean boys?
No, of course not. I just prefer picking my own dates. And I already have a boyfriend.
No, not this Kyle. He's wrong for you.
Mom, all you know about him is that he's American.
There's a hint in that line.
There's a lot of hints in there.
A lot of hints in that. That is All American Girl.
Well done.
Margaret Cho's
sitcom.
Yes, it is. Points off for being the only gay dude in the room.
That's true.
Gave me an unfair advantage.
In the high dive competition, that was just a straight shot into the pool.
Yeah. So tell us the history of that show. I mean, that lasted for just a few episodes.
Yeah, maybe
right?
like 5 or 6
Not
episodes.
Long at all. Yeah.
So I guess it premiered 20 years ago this
mm-hmm.
year. Obviously, as you heard, it was very, very broad. So it wasn't a good show. It was a terrible show. But also, it's sort of terrible and important because it was the only time we'd had a predominantly an all-Asian American
family.
Yeah,
it was the second one besides Mr. T and Tina from like the
70s. Oh, right.
Right. And so this fall, there's Fresh Off the Boat on ABC, which is a network. There's been a 20-year lull between the last time we've seen an Asian American family mm-hmm. on a network sitcom. So it's kind of a big deal. I mean, even though it was
a huge deal.
How many times do you think Asian-themed shows were pitched and the network said, no, All-American Girl, that didn't work?
I mean, that was probably everyone. Like,
we tried it
before. Margaret Cho
can do it, so you can't either.
You're no Cho, young lady.
Yeah. But I'm Chow.
That's true, you are Chow. All right, Jessica.
To fix Emily's neglected soul, I've set up some studio time so Emily can record her own rap.
We're going to write a rap tonight. Yes. You're going to focus on your confidence, your truth, and your what? Fearlessness.
Yeah. Me and the girlfriends, oh, we are down for whatever.
Don't you worry about a thing. Emmy is yours. Mother of two getting loose on the dance floor. $1 million house.
What?
$1 million lipstick. Girls shout love.
But they don't want it with missing.
Girls shout love.
But they don't want it with missing.
Girls shout love.
But they don't want it with missing.
Yes, honey. So white girls can rap. By the end, she was like, don't you worry about a thing. Like, oh, like a black girl, you know, with the headphones popping. I said, wait a minute. We done got us a sister.
Oh, yeah.
I just watched this episode today. It's even worse just hearing it.
Oh, it's
girlfriend
it is.
Intervention.
Let the record show that throughout the
I was going to say, I wanted to bring this up.
was not quite on the desk, but it was hovering very close. He had gone fetal.
No, the thing with Gene is his hands never left his face. The entire time. They were in different positions on his face. Oh. Sometimes they were covering your whole face.
Yeah.
They were clutching his pearls.
Yeah, indeed.
So, Gene, I've seen you.
Oh, my God.
Seen you live tweet this show. I was wondering, Gene, if you could give me some thoughts on Girlfriend Intervention.
Oh my God. So it's obviously supposed to be like a
Queer Eye for the Straight Guy.
Yeah, but it also made me like realize like, wow, Queer Eye was really backwards. Like, I mean, it was a very, like, the concept at the center of it was really janky. Like, if you're starting from the position of, like, hey, I have these people who are from a marginalized group who are going to make me a better person.
Give us a quick synopsis of Girlfriend Intervention.
If you haven't seen Girlfriend Intervention first, let's trade lives. The premise of the show is this idea that behind every basic white woman lives a black woman dying to burst out. And so there are four black women, a soul coach, a interior designer, a hair person, and a clothes person. Their job is to make over her life. And it is...
By basically making her sassier.
Making her sassier, right. And making her more bootylicious. I wish that was not the term that they used throughout the entire first two episodes, but yes. And then you think after the first episode when they went through the, no, she didn't, and Girlfriend, you think they blew their wad like on the first episode.
That's it.
And so many iterations and saying the phrase basic woman so many times, too.
Absolutely. And like snapping their fingers and a Z, and just like, okay, you did it the first week. How can you possibly do this again the second week?
Who would you say is most cheapened by this show? Is it us? It's us, isn't it?
I think, you know, America had a good run.
Yeah, sure.
We are all diminished by the existence of this show.
Let me just put in a good word for Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, which we loved when it came on. We absolutely loved it.
For like 6 months?
Yeah, and then it kind of exhausted itself. But I mean, there was such a sense. It came from a really good place. Mm. And I remember having that conversation. I was at a party with some other gay dudes, and this one guy was like, it's totally backwards. It's setting us back. It's the wrong thing to show to people. These are terrible stereotypes. It's awful. Gay men are more than this. Later, it came out that later evening, I asked him what he did for a living. He said, figure skating judge. So, right there.
So, this is just basically, like, we're all diminished by everything.
We are all diminished by everything.
Burn it all down.
Should be, burn it all down.
What, black sass for the white lass is not like all
Well, I think there's just a natural segue into what's making us happy this week. Kat Chow, what is making you happy this week?
What is making me very happy this week is this blog called Nerds of Color. And it's something that I started reading maybe a year or so ago, but every now and then it just kind of resurfaces into my feed. And basically it's run by a guy named Keith Chow. His handle is The Real Chow, which I take issue with. I'm going to have to change my handle to The Realist Chow or The Coolest. I don't even know. But basically it's an awesome blog. People say smart things. They're nerds of color and everyone should go check it out.
So what is the URL on that?
TheNerdsOfColor.org.
Excellent. Yes. Thank you, Kat Chow. Gene Demby.
What's making me happy this week is, if you've ever been on the internet before, you probably read XKCD, the web comic, which is just this former MIT student's web comic about random things that are interesting to him. And he started this spinoff series called What If, which is just like exploring kind of ridiculous scientific scenarios, like what would happen if everyone in the world jumped up at the same time and came back down, like what happened to the planet. The thing that happens to all these things is that, like, everyone dies. Like, that's what... The scenarios always end...
Good to know.
...with, like, some kind of, like, nuclear fission and then some kind of massive explosion. So there's a book out kind of collecting all of these, the best what-ifs. Like, what if someone threw a baseball at the speed of light? Everyone dies. spoiler alert.
Just tears a hole in the space-time continuum.
And then some of, like, the questions that he was like, why would you ask me this? Those questions are in there, too. It's been a really fun little before-you-go-to-sleep read. So
nice. What is the name of the book?
It's called What If.
What If by...
By Randall Munroe.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Gene Demby.
Yep.
Glenn Weldon, what do you got for us?
All right. Just a warning that this has a bit of a long wind-up, and it flirts with breaking the Zaxxon rule. Mm. But if you three just stay with me here in the room, there is a bit of audience participation about midway through, just to keep you interested. So.
Great.
Let's agree. Exercise is tedious. It's grueling. It's awful. It's no fun at all. Exercise on a treadmill is triply as bad. Yet, I am a person who has no cartilage in his right knee, thanks to an old rollerblading injury. That's not it. That's not the frustration part.
That's what's making me happy.
Leave it alone. Leave it alone. That was later compounded about 5 years later by a dog park injury, which makes it sound like a dog bit me. No, what in fact happened is my lovable dog was running up to meet me, and he came as soon as he got near me. He swerved. The 20 dogs that were chasing him did not re-injure that knee in a bad way. So now, no cartilage left in that knee, which means I have become a connoisseur of the elliptical machine. Hmm. And have become more of a connoisseur lately because I shortly have a author photo coming up. You know, I got away without one in the first book because I hate them, but it's coming up. And so I've been on a program and I've been doing it and I've lost about 20 pounds.
Nice. Congrats. Congratulations.
This is the audience participation. Yeah,
that's good. Awesome. Good. Started making more gun show jokes lately. But we were at a vacation at a fancy hotel last week, which had an elliptical machine, the likes of which I have never seen. It had a large video monitor, a touch video monitor, and if you hit the word outdoors once you strapped yourself into the machine, you saw, as you did your exercise, a point-of-view video camera shot of somebody running through either a lakeside park or through the streets of San Francisco, technically the waterfront of San Francisco, or a country road. And it was amazing what this thing did. I'll preface it by saying it didn't make me happy, but it is so weird. Your first thought, of course, is this is awesome.
Which one did you choose?
I chose first the lakeside. And of course, it's a lake near San Francisco, so it's like, oh, there's a mixed race gay couple with a baby. Hey guys, as you're going down, it's like this is so awesome. And then you start to notice, okay, there's a lot of dogs in this park. There's probably too many dogs in this park, and none of them are on leashes. And I just got a little brown acid flashback. But it's such a weird cognitive dissonance because you don't control where you're going. You're following whatever route this guy ran when he ran it originally, and it's just weirdly insidious. Because your body is telling your brain that you're running through this park. You are seeing yourself run through this park, but you are not. You can't turn your head, for one thing. So as you go past the lake, you'd love to be able to look at the lake, but it's just keep going straight, keep going straight. And you can't control your path. So you get to this, when he decides he's going to take go down the hill as opposed to up, you're like, ugh, because that's a feeling you don't ever have. I'm not in control of my body now. And then he goes down, and for like 10 minutes of this run, he is going past like a strip mall. And I'm like, I did not choose. Parked Mazdas. I selected Lakeside. And so it just keeps going on like that. And then you come to a place because your brain can't handle this input. I went to a place like, where have we come as a species? What is this about? This is some Philip K. Dick stuff right here. This is weird. And finally, the last thing you think of as you're seeing all these faces pass by you is what of privacy? Is there somebody behind this guy running, making every one of these 80 people in this park sign a waiver? Because there are, you can see every face. It's not like Google Street View. Everybody is there. And it's like if that mixed race gay couple could be like either cheating on their spouses with each other, or maybe they're stealing that baby. You don't know. So I'm just waiting for the day when the Techno Gym Cardio Wave 700E is rolled into a courtroom someday as evidence. So not the experience of exercise, certainly, but that weird cognitive dissonant experience is what was making me happy.
Could you control the speed in that?
You could, yeah. You could speed up and slow down.
I bought an elliptical machine on Craigslist recently, and it's just got a little panel that gives you a calorie counter, like how many calories you've burned. Yeah. And so I get on it, and I never use this thing. And I'm like, and it went in that time, the time it took me to like get winded, it went from 821.2 to 822.6.
There you go.
So I burned 1.4 calories in the time it took me to get sick of it. Well, in terms of what's making me happy this week, a couple weeks ago, it was a rough week for the internet. Without going into detail, there was a lot of generalized and specific unfriendliness directed toward a lot of people who didn't deserve it. And right at the end of the week, a website called FandomNetwork.com, which is the online magazine of Jeppy's Entertainment Museum in Baltimore, which I've spoken about on this show before. It's the pop culture museum in Baltimore. I can no longer speak of this museum in anything resembling an unbiased way, because on this Friday, the end of a grueling week for the internet, FandomNetwork.com decided to not only run an interview with my mother, Maggie Thompson, but they just decided, and this is entirely to be nice to her, entirely a gesture of kindness. They ran these commentaries, these testimonials from Missy Bowersox, Steve Jeppy, Bob Overstreet, Michael Davis, Steve Borok, John Jackson Miller, and J.C. Vaughn that are basically all about, you know who's great? Maggie Thompson. Mm-hmm. And it was this reminder And I do recommend, if you have any interest in My Mother whatsoever, and I know it seems like the Zaxxon Rule, but it's a real website about that she's, I mean, it was published, deemed worthy of publication.
On the internet.
On the internet. No less an authority than the internet itself. And it was this reminder that the internet, as destructive a force as the internet can be when harnessed by the wrong people, can also be a force of goodness and gallantry when harnessed by the right people. And I found it incredibly inspiring, and I believe it was the Friday before Labor Day weekend that it went up, and so I just kind of went into this long weekend like, you know who can be all right? People. So fandomnetwork.com and their wonderful, wonderful treatment of My Mother, which is certainly one of the fastest ways to my heart.
That's awesome.
And that brings us to the end of Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at I Dislike Steven. That's STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn Weldon at GHWeldon, that's WELDON. You can follow Kat Chow at Kat Chow, that's KATCHOW. And you can follow Gene Demby at GD215, that's GEEDEE, and then the number 215. You can follow our absent pal Linda Holmes at NPR Monkey C. You can follow our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy, REEDY. You can follow our other producer Nick Fountain at Nick, like Nick. Fountain, like Fountain. You can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, that's KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to now. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts, including Intelligence Squared US, Oxford-style debates recorded live in New York. After hearing the world's leading authorities share surprising facts and reasoned analysis, you might just rethink your point of view on some big issues. Find Intelligence Squared US on iTunes under podcasts.